Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering a peaceful homecoming at Queen's University.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
After an uncharacteristically quiet few weeks in the University District, the University District Safety Initiative has now been lifted, marking an end to what is typically the fall party season. Homecoming, FOCO, and Halloweekend all passed without much fanfare, prompting mixed reactions. For Bylaw and Kingston Police, the weekends were considered a success. Dan Hazel, supervisor of enforcement with the city, had this to say.
I'm really happy to report back to the community and the Queens community that this year's homecoming, the official weekend, was a very successful event. Very quiet on the enforcement end. There was really no hotspots of concern throughout the entire weekend. It was exceptionally quiet. It was nice to see the alumni back to our community. The oldest coat I saw was a 1972 alumni. Had a quick discussion on him, and it was really nice to see them come back to the community. For the second weekend, we did issue 13 penalty notices under the Administrative Monetary Penalties Bylaw, which is a very low number comparison to the last previous years. So I would say that the second weekend was also successful. I think from my side of the table, I just want to give a huge thank you to all of our community partners, the Queens community, Queens University, Kingston Police, the police liaison teams, and to the enforcement officers that were all on duty for the event to make it as safe as possible.
Hazel attributed the success to the work done leading up to the weekend, particularly improved communication and outreach with students.
I think the main factor right now is the communication ahead of the events, exceptional coordination amongst the Queens University community, the AMS, the Kingston Police and Bylaw Enforcement, really just to identify the areas or times that we might need it, using social media posts and getting the information out to the public on what the University Safety District Initiative is. All those efforts seem to be trending as a community in the right direction. And it seems that the events are now becoming less and less enforcement based and more community oriented, which we're very happy to see. So I suspect for the future, into the next years, we could continue with those models, with the ultimate goal of having these events go off and no community safety concerns.
However, the biggest conversation among students and alumni wasn't about enforcement. It was about timing. Students and alumni continue to express frustration that homecoming has been scheduled during reading week in recent years, saying the shift has made it difficult for current students and returning grads to connect. Queen's undergraduate student Hannah Harrison voiced that feeling in a video posted on TikTok.
I think Queen's is absolutely diabolical for always making our HOCO on a day when it's our reading week and none of the students are here, and here's why. So yesterday, I was visiting a family member who it was their 20th reunion from graduating from Queen's. We were at the Queen's pub, and I went to the bar to get a drink, and there was a guy there who's got to be at least 85 years old. Okay, he graduated in like 1960. Okay, so do the math. And he's looking around, he looks kind of sad, and I was like, oh, hi, sir, like, are you all right? Are you looking for someone? And he goes, well, I'm looking for the students. Where are the students? And I said, well, it's our reading week. Like, nobody's really here. And he goes, that makes me so sad because what I look forward to the most about coming back to Queens is seeing all of you being so happy and having fun with your friends and reminding me of the best time of my life. So after my heart broke a little, I thought about it. And honestly, the whole point of Queens making homecoming on our reading week is so that we don't drink and party too much. Well, we just do it the next weekend anyway, so it literally changes nothing for us. However, it ruins the experience for the alumni who want to come back here and party like they're 20 again.
That sentiment has been echoed across social media by students and alumni alike, with many alumni saying they plan to include it in their feedback to the university. When asked about the scheduling choice, Queens responded in a written statement, quote, "The event took place on the third weekend of October, consistent with past years. Students continue to play an important role through volunteerism within their faculties and by supporting events, helping to create a welcoming experience for returning graduates," end quote. The university also noted that this year marks one of the highest attended homecoming weekends in recent years, reflecting a steady increase in alumni engagement over the past 3 years. Looking ahead, the 2026 dates are set for October 16th to 18th, once again landing at the tail end of Reading Week. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about an ongoing hospital funding debate in Gananoque.
Thank you, Jesse. As Gananoque edges closer to its next municipal budget cycle, a familiar question is resurfacing. Should local tax dollars be used to support area hospitals, or should those contributions remain a personal choice? Councillor David Osmond says he continues to support hospital foundations personally, but remains hesitant to back municipal funding commitments that would increase the town's tax burden. In a statement this week, Osmond said he recently received thank you letters from both the University Hospitals Kingston Foundation and the Brockville and District Hospital Foundation for his individual donation and encouraged residents who were able to do the same. The issue has been a point of tension for more than a year. In December 2023, Council voted against a proposed five-year pledge of $75,000 annually to support hospital upgrades in Kingston, citing concerns about the strain on local finances and arguing healthcare funding should fall to the province. Public backlash led Council to reconsider the matter in 2024, but in early 2025, Council ultimately opted for a one-time donation rather than a recurring commitment. Osmond said rising operational costs, provincial asset management requirements, and the town's upcoming transition to a strong mayor budget process all leave limited flexibility. Osmond emphasized he is open to continued discussion and recognizes the value of hospital foundations, but maintains that those able to donate personally should do so. "Anyone that is upset with my opinion on this can quantify that feeling and donate accordingly, knowing your neighbor may not be as fortunate," he said. The town is expected to revisit the funding question during its 2026 budget deliberations. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with his Queen's University sports report.
Thank you, Dinah. The Queen's Gaels men's football team was in action in Waterloo last weekend, looking to take home their first Yates Cup in nearly 16 years. The Gaels entered the game as the OUA's 4 seed, fresh off victories over McMaster and Windsor in the preceding weeks. They were matched up against the reigning, defending, undefeated 2024 Yates Cup champions, the Laurier Golden Hawks. These two teams had met earlier in the season at Richardson Stadium here in Kingston, a game Laurier won handedly by the score of 47-32. If there was any apprehension from the Gaels heading into this game, you could not tell, as they came out of the gates hot with an early interception from rookie linebacker number 30, Jacob Baldwin. That turnover resulted in a 14-yard touchdown pass from quarterback Alex Vraken to slot back Cedric Smith. Gaels draw first blood, taking a 7-0 lead. The next Laurier drive ended much the same as the last, with fifth-year defensive back Jared Seaway knocking a pass out of the hands of the intended receiver and into the hands of his teammate, linebacker number 44, Justin Pace. Two drives, two turnovers, both that resulted in points. Queens entered the second quarter up 10-3. Laurier would turn the ball over twice in the second, with Jacob Baldwin picking up his second interception of the game, running quarterback Cal Withers' pass into Laurier's red zone. Unfortunately, Baldwin would be injured on the play and did not return to the game. Alex Vraken scored his second touchdown of the game to put Queens up 17-3. The next drive, Cal Withers threw another interception, once again to Justin Pace, who would run that ball back for a touchdown. Queens entered the half up 27-3. Now, if the first half belonged to the Gaels, the second unquestionably belonged to the Golden Hawks. Laurier slowly but surely chipped away at the Queens lead, cutting it down to 17. It was 30-13 at the start of the fourth quarter. Laurier would score two touchdowns in the final quarter to cut that deficit down to just 3 points. But the Gaels rallied late and held on thanks to outstanding plays from Stephen Capea, John Corscadden, and Jared Kasari. Queens wins 32-27, shocking the undefeated, top-ranked Golden Hawks and snapping a 16-year title drought. This is the 24th Yates Cup victory in program history. Queens will travel to Saskatoon on Thursday ahead of their Mitchell Bowl matchup with the Saskatchewan Huskies. The winner of that contest will advance to the Vanier Cup. CFRC's coverage of the Mitchell Bowl begins at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, with kickoff scheduled for 3:15.
Thank you, Jesse. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the possible creation of the Veterans Crosswalk in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Loyalist Township Council heard a presentation from a member of the public regarding crosswalks in honor of Canadian veterans. Isabella Harpel spoke about the sacrifices made by veterans and asked that council consider implementing these crosswalks throughout the township by next year. Harpel noted that recognition should extend beyond November 11th.
The world wars are a part of our history, and the men and women that fought and died should be remembered not only on November 11th, but through the year. We need to honor and prioritize the men and women that have sacrificed the ultimate by giving their life. We need to demonstrate to our courageous veterans that they are deeply appreciated and will always be appreciated.
Harpel went on to speak about the two new veterans crosswalks in Kingston and others popping up across the region.
From the research that I have completed just this past week, the City of Kingston will be placing the veterans crosswalks this year. The cost of the crosswalks range around $3,000. The City of Kingston, they purchase and the crosswalks themselves. Belleville, I spoke to Bill McDonald there. The cost for their crosswalks were $5,000 to $6,000. He couldn't remember exactly what it was. Their crosswalks were funded by community groups, and they were constructed and painted just prior to November 11th. And when I did research, there are many little hamlets that are now implementing this procedure of veteran crosswalks.
Crosswalks at the corner of Ontario and Lower Union Streets in Kingston were recently opened, along with a short ceremony. Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend agreed that remembering veterans' sacrifices should extend beyond Remembrance Day on November 11th.
It's appropriate to remember the sacrifice of our armed services beyond the 11th, and we should try and do everything we can to honor the memory of their sacrifice and our duty to remember.
Council agreed to refer the matter to staff so they could review existing sidewalk replacement schedules and examine any other opportunities to install a veterans crosswalk in the township.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about the fallout from the Auditor General's report on the Skills Development Fund allocations.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. Ontario Liberal MPP Stephanie Smythe has written to the Integrity Commissioner to investigate how Minister of Labour, Immigration, Training and Skills Development David Pacini administered the Skills Development Fund. The Auditor General concluded that Pacini's office was not transparent in how it awarded proposals.
I filed the letter with the Integrity Commissioner, the request on Friday, and formally asked the Commissioner to investigate whether the Labour Minister, Mr. Pacini, violated the Members' Integrity Act or breached parliamentary ethics in his handling of the $2.5 billion Skills Development Fund. And I made it clear that this isn't just about who the Minister is friends with. I'm sure you might have heard this discussion going on. But the issue is whether he used his public office to benefit that friends, and clients in ways that might have broken the law. And we know, Dan, that the Auditor General has already found that the Skills Development Fund was not fair, transparent, or accountable. And now we're asking the Integrity Commissioner to determine whether the Minister's conduct crossed ethical or legal lines and whether he advanced private or political interests or gave preferential treatment to insiders or breached conflict of interest provisions under the Members Integrity Act.
Now, there is a photo of Mr. Pacini at a hockey game with his wife and an apparent person that was interested in the Skills Development Fund, and he's also admitted to going to a wedding in Paris. Do you believe that this is a pay-for-play situation?
Well, we believe it certainly is. And here's what we know. And I don't know if you saw our board, Dan, that we used yesterday. I have a TV background. So we just created this board that sort of shows a web of connection, this circular economy of donors giving money to the PCs and then the conservatives giving the money back, you know. So it's just this intricate web. And it's a web of connections. So what we know is lobbyist Michael Rutterham, a longtime personal friend of Minister Pacini's, secured more than $8.5 million in public funding for his clients through his program, including $7.5 million for Keel Digital Solutions, and then $1.2 million for Life Labs. Now, Rutterham's lobbying registrations for both companies were active when these funds were approved. And then Mr. Pacini personally intervened on Keel's application. And its project public servants have ranked really poorly, and then later admitted that his office overruled that internal evaluation to turn around and fund lower scoring projects that, you know, aligned with government priorities. And he even named the Keel project on live radio as an example. And a year and a half before that, you referenced this hockey game. The minister was photographed sitting, yes, rinkside at that Leafs game with Peter Zakharov, a Keel director. And we now know that those are Zakharov family seats, right? And within a year, Keel's low-ranked proposal received millions in public funds. So, and then as the Auditor General's report was released in October, the minister appeared remotely from Paris, later confirmed to be attending Mr. Rutterham's luxury wedding at the Four Seasons, a lobbyist whose clients had, you know, again, benefited directly from his ministry. So taken all together, Dan, these facts paint a really disturbing picture to us, a minister using public power to advance private connections. And we believe that Ontarians deserve better. They expect that their public dollars will help workers and employers and not the donors and not the insiders. And that's the way the Skills Development Fund was supposed to build Ontario's workforce and not, you know, bankroll political friends.
Now, there's two kind of, you separate that, there's two issues here. There's one with how the Skills Development Fund was used to rank lower projects and how those were used. Now, Mr. Pacini has defended that in saying that these projects, while they did rank low, they did help people get into the skills and jobs. So it was kind of doing what it was intended. But the second issue is the perception of what you've brought up. So are you in favor of, I know you kind of brought this up in terms of wanting him to resign or quit. Are you asking him to resign over what he's done with the program low ranking proposals, or is it he's got a perception of giving money to his perceived buddies?
Well, it's, you know, all of the above is disastrous. Listen, you said the program worked, but it didn't, right? In fact, you know, they did not give to the highest ranked for whatever reason. And we don't know what the ranking criteria is, right? So this is all leading to, we think he should be fired immediately by the premier, calling on that, right? So we don't know that, and they're not even tracking who got what job, right? And where the money has gone, exactly why it's gone there, and what exactly has been the outcome of these hardworking Ontarian dollars, right? They're not. We can't even be told by the government that these are full-time, part-time, or temporary jobs. So there's absolutely no accountability.
Now, in terms of yesterday when you brought this up on Monday, the Abacus poll came out, and it believed that more than half the respondents suggested that Mr. Pacini resign or quit or be fired. But 57% of the respondents didn't quite know what the controversy was. How much weight do you put into this poll?
Well, I think like any poll, you know, you look at the margin of error, you look at the number of people polled, but the fact of the matter is it's an Abacus data poll, and we look at it, we think, you know, from our perspective, people are watching, they're starting to catch on. I know it's very, very easy to get distracted by a premier who pours out Crown Royal or who eats an ice cream bar or talks about speed cameras to make us look over there at this bright, shiny object. Meanwhile, you know, they're tabling omnibus bills that have horrible impacts on renters, etc. People do care, bottom line, about where their money goes. And what we're doing is showing that. We're displaying that on our web of connections. We're going to not stop talking about it and not stop holding this government to account.
Representatives for Buccini did not respond to a request for comment. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region. And a hearty congratulations on behalf of CFRC 101.9 FM to Jesse Bell upon calling his 50th Gales football game on CFRC radio during the Yates Cup last weekend. Best wishes to him as he journeys with the Queen's Gales this weekend to Saskatoon to cover the Mitchell Cup national semifinal game as the Gales face off against the Saskatchewan Huskies at Griffith Stadium. Now over to Jesse with the weather.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, November 13th, daytime high of 7 degrees with a little wet snow in the forecast, but we're talking less than a millimeter or so. It's going to feel closer to 2 degrees, very chilly, very breezy day here in the city of Kingston. Friday, November 14th, we're going to have the holdover from that Thursday squall, some trace amounts of freezing rain, once again, less than 1 millimeter in terms of accumulation, and that'll be in the morning before warming up a little bit and clearing into the afternoon. Saturday, November 15th, daytime high of 3 degrees, mix of sun and cloud. Sunday, November 16th, daytime high of 5 degrees, with a 70% chance of precipitation in the forecast, dropping down to 1 overnight. And then starting off next week, Monday, November 17th, daytime high of 5, a mostly cloudy day here in the city of Kingston. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Reminder that the LaSalle Causeway will be closed on November 16th from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., so that's closed for all vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians to allow for temporary opening of the main marine navigation channel. Here are some relevant road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed for construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess 2 Mac is closed for construction activity and staging at 484 Albert. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne closed for construction activity at 283 Queen. Earl Street, Collingwood 2 Toronto, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. King Street, tragically hip way to Place d'Armes, closed November 12th at 8 p.m. to November 14th at 8 a.m. for event-related parking and storage at Slush Puppy Place. Kings Court Avenue, concession to First, closed until November 21st for gas main installation by Utilities Kingston. Raglan Road, Division Domain, closed until November 30th from 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. each day for a gas main installation. Toronto Street, Durham to Park, closed until November 28th for installation of new water, sanitary, and storm services. And Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.